Our guest this morning is Jack Gorey. Today's interview was actually promulgated from a conversation that Jack and I had at the Music Boosters Chili Feed last fall. Sat down next to each other and got to talking about, I don't know, times out of the past, and one thing led to another. And let me start. Let's kind of back up and not talk about your military life and your days of flying, but let's talk about you and your family background so we kind of put you into perspective. Were you born and raised here?
I was born in Whidbey Island at Oak Harbor. And when I was about 4 years old, I moved to Brewster, and I was raised in Brewster, actually. And from Brewster, I went to Seattle and attended the University of Washington for a while. I never did graduate. The war came up, and at the rate I was going to school, I took a short course because not too many hours every quarter because I was working my way through school. And from there, well, I went into the service.
Were you drafted, or did you volunteer?
I volunteered because the draft was right on my neck, and I thought it was better to join. At that time, everybody was real excited about the war. I was over there, and, for instance, the first I knew about it, I worked downtown in a parking lot, and there were some English Marines that were on board an English ship that had been damaged quite severely in some encounters, I think, around Crete. And they were over at the Bremerton Navy Yard getting repairs. And that's the first time that you actually saw anyone that had been in the fighting.
What year was it that you joined?
Actually, I joined in 1941. I believe I had to report at San Antonio the day after what they call Veterans Day now, November the 12th. And I went into a pre-flight school there, and we were the first group that had gone to a pre-flight school. Usually, when you went in for pilot's training, you started right in at primary, and then basic, and then advanced. But I was in the first group that had about a month service in pre-flight school.
You enlisted then in the Air Force?
Yes.
It wasn't called the Air Force then, though, was it?
No, it was the Army Air Corps, the old Army Air Corps, part of the Army.
Chuck, was it difficult to get in?
Oh, they lowered the requirements, I think, at that time quite a bit. They realized they had to build up a bigger Air Force, and talking about pre-Pearl Harbor, everybody was very patriotic. In other words, over in Seattle, if you drove like between Seattle and Tacoma, there'd be maybe some Army trucks from Fort Lewis there, and they'd see you were a young fella. They'd motion for you to come join us. Everybody, the thing to do now is to get in the service. And that's kind of the way it was. It was very patriotic at that time.
Did you recognize it as being patriotic, or did you just think it was the thing?
Well, I took a long, hard look at it, and I think we were all very patriotic. We weren't real anxious to get in there, get in the service. Back up, you know, if they told us we had to, why, we went ahead and did it.
Was it chivalry type of patriotism, or was it bravery type of patriotism?
That's hard to tell. I guess it was chivalry. I mean, you just...
So you joined the Army Air Corps in 1941. You opted to go into flying. Was that difficult to do?
No, not really difficult.
Seems like that would have been one of those things that almost everyone would have wanted to do.
That's correct. I think the only requirement was that you had to have 2 years of college at that time, and then pass a stiff physical examination.
And you passed?
Yes. I had a little time. At first, I tried to get in the Navy Air Force, or Air Corps, they called it at that time, and I can't remember what the trouble was. I think it was my eyes that they said didn't quite make it, so I tried the Army Air Corps, they called it that time, and I passed it.
Steve, is there anything you'd like to correlate between the induction process and...
I was wondering, when were you commissioned? Were you commissioned going in?
No. You go in as an aviation cadet, then you're enlisted until you pass the flight school.
I see.
And then you're commissioned.
Just because you had the college, you weren't commissioned automatically?
Oh, no.
They do that today, I understand. If you're a college graduate, if you so decide, you're an officer going in.
No, we've all went in for pilot's training, and they'd wash quite a few of them out if they didn't think they'd make a pilot, and then they'd either go in like bombardier or navigator, or maybe they'd make them some kind of a, well, you might say a communications officer. Some of them went into, they'd go into other fields if they didn't make it as a pilot.
Was the whole air crew officers, or the bombardiers, those people could be enlisted?
No, you had both. I ended up as a, well, they called it an aircraft commander on a B-24. We had a crew of, well, it started out with 9 men, and after we were overseas a while, they increased it to 10. And you'd have, usually you had 4 officers and then 5 or 6 enlisted men on the crew.
Well, let's go back. I want to ask you about, did you go through boot camp, for example, what we'd commonly
refer? Well, your pre-flight school was actually a boot camp. When you first went in, they made you send all your civilian clothes home. They issued you a uniform. You were.
Did they give you a haircut?
You betcha they gave you a haircut. That was right down to the skin. And that we were also quarantined for, I can't remember whether it was 3 weeks or 4 weeks. In other words, we couldn't leave the base. Well, they wanted to get you indoctrinated for the Army, and I suppose to maybe some medical reason. And actually, on the day of Pearl Harbor, I was on my first leave since I'd been in the service. I'd been in either 3 or 4 weeks, well, from November 12th to December 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was one of the lucky ones and had a car, and we were watching some jalopy races at San Antonio when it came on the radio about Pearl Harbor at the time.
When you went into the service, did you anticipate that you would actually be serving overseas?
Well, it seemed like there was a good chance of it.
And what did you think about that? Did you see that as an exciting adventure, something you felt like you should do? If you didn't, you'd be embarrassed and to your peers?
I think we all kind of looked, I can't say that you looked forward to it. You were kind of, well, you just might as well say it. You're a little bit scared, you know, if you're going to go over across the ocean. You don't know whether you'll be back or not. But nobody really realized what we were headed for at that time. We just put that. We knew we were going to, something was going to come about in militarily, but we didn't know just exactly what.
I always wonder when a man goes into combat, particularly a foot soldier, if he has any conception. I certainly don't. And I wonder if he realizes, and we'll get around to talking about those experiences that you went through, because
mm-hmm.
I found them most fascinating. Steve?
I was wondering, you said you were at some stock car races or something in San Antonio, Texas, when the announcement of Pearl Harbor. What was the reaction of the crowd, the group?
You just couldn't hardly believe it at first. I mean, you'd listen to the radio. We listened to the automobile radio. We didn't know whether we were supposed to hurry up and get back to the base or just what we were supposed to do. And we had to be back that evening anyway. And we had been briefed quite a bit on what to do, that we were supposed to get right back there.
That was your first leave, first chance off base?
Yes, that's right.
Were you with the other military men?
Oh, yes, there was. I had some of my classmates with me, we called them, and then there were some of the upperclassmen out at the auto races there, too, and of course we asked them what to do, and they couldn't give us a good answer. They didn't know either.
What did you do?
Well, we went back to the base, and the cadets that they called us, we didn't have any trouble getting back on the base, but I don't know, they didn't have much security at that time, and so a lot of the officers, it was 2 or 3 days before they could get back on the base. They didn't have any way of identifying themselves, no ID card.
I'll be darned. That's interesting.
It was very confusing there for a while.
At this point, had you had any training in flight training at all?
No, none whatsoever. Okay. Just marching, and they marched us all day.
Okay, let's go from there. Let's go through the educational process that you went through within the service from that time on, from Pearl Harbor on, till actually you found yourself on your way overseas.
All right. I think the best thing to do when you're talking about your military experiences is tell about the funny things that happened, because I don't know, you get more kick out of that. And as my family says, you said something about lived in a place 50 years and a liar. I can't say that you're exactly lying, but my family tells me my stories get better every time I tell them, so I don't know.
Okay. It's all yours.
Well, from pre-flight, we went to... I was down in Texas, naturally, and first we went through primary and then basic and advanced, and then you're assigned to a base. I went through primary at Ballinger. About the only thing that funny that happened there, they had one cadet that, well, he was up for his final washout ride, they call it. They decided that he'd be something better than a pilot. And the instructor was busy, and he was going for a ride with the head instructor, and the instructor told him to go out and start up the airplane and wait for him. And he was going to come out and give him his last ride. Well, this fella decided he'd show them he could be a pilot. So he didn't wait for the instructor, and he just took off on his own. In other words, he stole the airplane and went for a ride. Well, the first thing they knew that happened, they saw this fella out here, and he was trying to do the craziest things in an airplane you ever saw. And, I don't know, he flew around there for about an hour and a half, or 2 hours maybe, and finally came back in and landed, and bounced all over the field, but he made it back. Well, he was confined to the quarters, and I don't know whatever happened to him, but he was gone in 2 or 3 days. And from there we went to basic, and we flew a pretty cranky airplane there. They called it a Vol T-13. BT-13, a Vol-T type, 450 horsepower.
This is a trainer?
Yes, I was a trainer.
Tandem seats?
Tandem seats.
Joystick?
Right.
Where was the, this is, to some listeners will mean nothing, but was the throttle control on the side panel?
Yes.
Kind of a lever type thing?
Yeah, had a two-speed prop, in other words.
A variable
high,
pitch?
High and a low.
Was it a variable pitch or just a
two? No, just a two-speed, a high and a low range. And when we when you were in basic, why, you started all sorts of new types of training. That's where you got your first cross country, your first night flying, your first instrument flying, and
450 horsepower. That's quite an airplane to be training in, isn't it?
Oh, you bet. They figured when you could fly that and do it well, you could fly most anything that came along. Some things I don't know whether they still do it or not, but we had to. When we started out on instruments, they'd do what you called unusual maneuvers. In other words, the instructor would take you out there and turn you upside down and say, well, it's yours. And try and figure out what to do. Well, my instructor did that to me one day. He turned me upside down. I couldn't tell what was on. The hood was over. You couldn't see out. Instead of rolling it over, why, I did a split S out. And we built up a terrific airspeed. And I don't know what happened, but part of the cowling came loose, and the cowling was just hanging down. So we had to go back to the field, and when we landed, why, the rest of the cowling fell off on the ramp. And I don't know, as I remember it, why the instructor and I both, well, we got talked to pretty good.
Yeah.
I got it for flying that way, and he got it because he let me.
I see. Okay. So you learned, took basic training, and from then, then did you go, where did you go for your multi-engine training?
At this point, had they decided if you were going to be a bomber pilot or a fighter pilot or what? There was no decision yet.
No decision. Everything was, like I say, they were building up so fast. I went to advanced, and when you went to advanced, they usually had decided what type of pilot you'd be, whether it be multi-engine or whether it be fighter pilots. When I went to advanced, we had both single and twin-engine aircraft. So we got to fly three different airplanes, really. We had a AT-6 with 600 horsepower, and we had what they called an AT-9, which was a little twin-engine plane. And I think they used that to train P-38 pilots in, kind of a hot, little hot twin-engine plane. And then we had one that was... Cessna UC-78, I think they call it, kind of a fabulous company. It was slow, but you got some good twin-engine training. And from there, when I graduated and got my wings, the first field I was sent to was Sebring, Florida. And just to show you how much confusion there was at that time, nobody at the air base knew what kind of aircraft they had at Sebring, Florida. They thought it was fighter planes. When we got there, it was a four-engine B-17. And that's where they first started using the checklist on the larger type airplane.
Hey, so what happened when you arrived on the base? You thought you were going to be a fighter pilot, and all of a sudden you saw these birds out there with four engines.
Well, that's right. And I don't know, for some reason, I was 3 or 4 days late getting it to the base, or the orders were confused, and I didn't get there on time. And the first time I went up was at night. And I don't know what this instructor thought, but he thought I had some time in a B-17. He told me to get up in the pilot seat and land that thing at night, the first time I was in it, in a four-engine airplane. And I tell you, it was a little bit comical there. He'd,
yeah.
He'd say, well, what are you going to do about your superchargers? Oh, let me see. I'd had a little bit about superchargers in ground school, so I just said, well, set the superchargers. And pretty soon he was looking at me a little bit... funny, and got me out of the pilot seat, and he called me up there. He said, how much time do you have in a B-17? And I said, this is the first time I was ever inside of one. Well, he just threw his hands up.
What happened then? You must have gone on and been trained.
That's right. We'd have a regular training there in a B-17. We had the crew set up. About the only funny thing that happened there was this friend of mine was on a crew, and a lot of times they'd send us out to practice bombing, and they'd load some practice bombs, and then they'd put one big depth charge in, and when you got done practicing your bombing, why, you'd go out on submarine patrol. Well, the only trouble they had was that they made their bombing run on the practice range there, and it was down a little bayou full of water. They made a mistake and dropped the depth charge instead of the practice bomb, and it just blew that bombing range practically dry. I mean, they just blew everything out of it.
This is kind of off the subject of your particular experiences, but I often wondered, you always hear stories, and in fact, you even wonder sometimes when you see the military aircraft buzz the Lake Chelan Valley here, if it's some pilot out on a Sunday afternoon training session, and he's snuck away from the base, and he's out doing a few spins and loops. And did you ever really sneak off and do anything like that?
Oh yes, in the old days, I mean, before things got so complicated, why you could get away with it real easy. Now, why everything's so complicated and they're so strict and they keep control of everyone so much, they really can get in trouble real easy, but we used to get away with it a lot. I mean, we did it in training, and it was actually part of our training a lot of times.
I see.
Did you do things like play chicken with a railroad train? I've heard of fighter pilots.
No, I've never played chicken with a railroad train.
Fly between the piles of a bridge?
What we used to do overseas on the old B-24s when we'd come home, we had a little radio aerial that was right on the bottom of the aircraft, and it had only missed the ground, I suppose, 6 or 7 inches when you had your landing gear down. Well, we'd come down and buzz and with our gear up and see if we could knock that aerial off. And that was a little rough to do, but a few of them succeeded.
Okay. Well, Jack, when was it that, what period of time, what year was it that you finally had completed all of your pre-flight training your flight training, and you were ready to serve? What day was that?
Well, it was 1943 in February. We were assigned our airplanes to fly overseas. Funny thing about that, when I signed for the airplane, they had a sheet of paper that you signed, you know, and it had one B-24 complete, one Norden bomb sight complete, and two rolls of TT. There was those three items on the deal, and I still have that thing at home. I like to show people the way they had you sign it. Now, why they had it itemized that way, there's no way to tell. A little bit ridiculous in a way, but...
How long did you stick with your airplane? You had an airplane that was yours.
I had an airplane that was mine.
Was it brand new when you
took... It was brand new. We picked it up in Salinas, Kansas. We were stationed at Topeka, Kansas, before we went overseas. We went on maneuvers down to Florida, which was real nice. It was a real bad winter in Topeka, Kansas, and we got to go down to Florida for about a week, check everything out, and then we flew back to Topeka and waited for our orders to go overseas.
Navigation that time, with navigation has come so far. Was navigation a problem at that time? You used a lot of low-frequency radios.
On navigation, they trained the navigators so fast that they really knew what they were doing, but sometimes you had a rough time to convince them that they were as good as they were. And a lot of times they wouldn't, believe. I remember one time in training in B-24s, I had my crew that we ended up, and the navigator that I ended up going overseas on, and we were supposed to do a night celestial navigation deal, with a kind of a three-legged trip, and we got an old airplane there that was a trainer, a B-24, and when we took off, the navigator told us the course we were supposed to fly, and we flew about 15 minutes, and he called on the intercom, and he says, "Doggone it, I told you guys to fly such and such a course." And we said, "Well, we are, Alex." "No, you're not, and I don't know, remember now, but we're about 70 degrees off." And we said, "Well, maybe you tell us how to set our gyro compasses up here with your magnetic compass, and we'll fly that one, Alex." And he said, "Okay." Well, I don't know, we flew about most of the night, and I don't know where we'd been exactly, but we were all over the United States pretty well. He'd take a celestial shot, and he wouldn't believe it. He was so far off. So finally, we did a orientation problem on the Kansas City beam and got back to the base all right. There's no problem there.
Night flying, that's an experience in itself. Jack, Steve says we better break away. You have a word from somebody, Steve?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Jerry, yesterday we took an opportunity to visit the Sears Merchant Store here in downtown Chelan, and we're told of a couple of items that I think we should pass along to our second cup of coffee listeners. Sears right now has some $50 savings on a couple of television sets that might interest you. If you have been looking for a color television set, maybe a second set, a smaller set, what have you, Sears now has two 18-inch color sets, and both of them are reduced $50. One now sells for $392, and the second one, which is a Sears Best, at $412, and that includes the latest VistaView screen. Sears Best, 18-inch, color portable, $50 off. There's two different models to take a look at. While we're mentioning things electronic, Jer, there is a terrific buy right now at the Sears Merchant Store for those of you who are in the market for a stereo system, a component part stereo system for your home, including, of course, AM and FM tuner, FM multiplex for stereo, has the turntable on it and the 8-track tape deck as well, plus two separate speakers that are good size. And the normal retail on this price from Sears is $201, and right now it's $151, so it's another $50 savings in the electronic department at Sears. And we should be mentioning that March 12th, coming up, it's not too far away, March 12th is the last time, last chance to order from the special winter sales catalog. It's the biggest sale of the year for Sears. They have a catalog with some 6,000 items, all price reduced. And March 12th is the last day to buy. If you'd like to take a look at the comparison in price with things going up, you can take a look at the Just Out Spring Summer Sears Big Book and compare it with items that you'll find in this winter sale catalog, and you will really be able to see the price differences. 6,000 different items from every department that Sears is known to offer. Nothing down, of course, with your approved Sears credit. And we also might mention the fact once again that March 12th is the deadline, so drop in and compare. That's Sears.
Okay. We have 17 before 9. Our guest this morning is Jack Gorey, and talking about World War II and his days. Jack, so as you left to fly overseas, you had a crew of, I think you said either 9 or 10 men, I'm not sure.
We had a crew of 9 when we went over.
And you were flying?
A B-24.
Okay. Now, for those of us that are too old or too young, too young to know what a B-24 was or is, what is it? What is a B-24?
Well, a B-24 was a four-engine airplane. At that time, it was the biggest airplane that the Air Force had. It was slightly bigger than a B-17. It was the first plane that had a tricycle landing gear that size. It had a different type wing.
That was retractable gear, too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it had four 1,200 horsepower Pratt & Whitney engines.
Could that airplane operate on just two engines? Could
oh, it? Yes. Yes.
Okay. What was its payload capacity? What kind of...
Well, when we were overseas, we figured that our gross load was somewhere between 50 and 55,000 with our load. We always carried a double load of ammunition, and it would depend on how far we flew on how many bombs we carried. It was usually between, if it wasn't too far, we called what we called a dozen roses. In other words, it was 12 1,000-pound bombs. And if you had a long ways to go, they'd put in two Bombay fuel tanks extra, and you'd maybe cut down to six bombs.
You tell us about the cannons they had on board, the firepower other than the bombs.
For our own protection, they used 50 caliber machine guns, and you had a upper turret with 250 calibers.
Was a bubble type thing on the top?
Yes. They were power turrets. In other words, you just twist the handle, and you could go around and around and raise the guns up and down. And you had your tail turret with a double 250s in it.
And you had a tail gunner there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you ever ride back there?
Yes. And if you think some of these circus rides or something, you should get in a tail turret, or better than that, in a we didn't have them when we first went overseas, but a ball turret down in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had the first ball turret that hit our group. And we had a few problems we had to solve using that type of a turret. The first thing that happened was that the gunner would get in there. Well, you'd call your fighters out whichever way they're going, coming in from around the clock, like 12 o'clock high, lower level, and 6 o'clock if they're coming in from the back. Well, after the poor gunner was in this ball turret and made couple three turns around, he didn't know which way was up, down, or anyway, it was very confusing. So we put some little metal tags just outside of his turret with the numbers on them, so he could keep orientated and
mm-hmm.
know what we were talking about and which way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And another problem we had on the first time we went out with this ball turret, why we the gunner would have to get in this turret, and then the other gunners in the back of the plane, they had a little hydraulic deal, and they'd have to put him down, and then he had to depend on them to use the hydraulic jack to get him back out of there, and had to turn it just a certain way to open the door to get out. And the first time we used this turret, we lowered it before we were quite at our bombing altitude. And gee, it was just like putting the brakes on the airplane. So from then on, we'd have the gunner in the turret ready to go, and we'd wait until we'd released our bombs and then lower it, because we were always going down right after we had dropped our bomb load.
You know, a guy wouldn't want to have claustrophobia, would he?
Oh, I tell you, that was something. I got in that ball turret once and check it out, and that was enough.
That's basically a glass sphere. It's a half semi-sphere, a half sphere, and it would protrude down. But you could pull it back into the aircraft so that when you landed, it didn't hit bottom.
That's right.
I see.
What about your front gunner? Did you have a gunner up front, or was that controlled from your cockpit?
No. When I first went overseas, they had three guns on a swivel. The lower one, the bombardier would handle, and then there was two out. The nose, and the navigator would stand up just behind the navigator, and he would handle those two, whichever he could only handle one at a time. It depend on which side the fighters might be coming in. And I know that my navigator and bombardier, they were always fighting. He'd say, "Doggone it, you stepped on something, or something had happened." When if they were using the guns, why they always accuse the other of getting in his way.
They later modified those, didn't they?
Later modified it, and you had a regular power turret in the nose. However, it was heavy, and it cut down the performance of your airplane quite a bit.
Did the man ride up front there?
Oh, yes.
Well, now, how effective was this kind of protection compared to a fighter, which was a much faster and more maneuverable?
The fighter decided on when to attack and so forth, and as you say, they were a lot faster, and they determined on how much fighting would be done. When we first went over, we weren't too accurate. However, if the fighters got in close enough to hit us, we could pretty well take care of them. And I know that there was an English officer came over and gave us some real helpful pointers on manning the machine guns, especially on our lead. On a bomber, you use a reverse lead. In other words, you fellas that go out and hunt birds, you know you lead the bird a little bit, but you're stationary. Well, up there, you see the bombers were going along, and like if you were firing at someone at right angles off of your right wing, for instance, you would have a reverse lead because your airplane is going ahead. So instead of going ahead of them, you'd have your lead behind them a ways. I don't know whether I explain a little bit.
What happened to the airplane when you took hits? Did you feel it at the controls bad? I mean, obviously, with a fighter coming in, you're obviously going to take something, whether or not it's critical or not. You would take you'd take your share.
Oh yeah, you'd get hit fairly often with your power turrets. Like for instance, if your tail gunner would turn his turret as far as it would go one way. You had to be on the controls of the airplane because
a gyro effect of that type of thing? He was creating
airplane
motion.
Airplane start crabbing, probably.
Yeah, turret would make enough difference there that it'd be a little bit hard to control. And, of course, we were flying a fairly tight formation flight. It'd be about 24 airplanes in the formation, and you flew real close to each other for mutual protection.
So you landed, you sat down in Europe, where at?
Well, I went to North Africa. I was, we left from West Palm Beach, and when you go overseas, you still don't know exactly where you're going to go. And they give you orders, and our orders were sealed. And after we were out over the water 2 hours, we could open our orders. In other words, they figured you were on your way to find out for sure where you were going. Of course, we fudged a little bit on just when we opened those orders. I don't think we waited the full 2 hours.
Hear that,
and,
Captain?
Ours was to report at Cairo
in Egypt.
And we flew to Puerto Rico and then down to South America, across over to Ascension Island to Accra, and then I think we went to a place called Maiduguri, Khartoum, and then Cairo. It took us about a week to fly over there.
Was the refueling a problem?
One time we had a little problem. We flew from British Guiana, and our regular stop was at Belém, at the mouth of the Amazon River. And they were out of gasoline, so they had us fly on farther to a little place called Fortaleza, which wasn't too far from Natal. And Natal was on the coast of Brazil. It wasn't a regular military stop. We had to buy some gasoline from Pan Am at that time. It was their base.
The climate was warm?
Natal... We were there 2 or 3 days, and the climate's wonderful. It's almost, it's just like Hawaii. I know I talked to some of the people that had been there and stationed there, and one fellow said, well, I asked him about the weather. He said, it's been the same every day since I've been here, and I've been here 7 months. So.
Mm-hmm. Was there different handling characteristics with the airplane as you flew different areas, different climate?
Yes, there is. Your biggest characteristic is if you're at a station at a base that has a higher altitude, like Denver, Colorado, for instance, there's a little difference in landing.
Okay. Hey, look, we got a whole bunch of things we want to cover. We have to pause for a commercial word, and we'll be back to continue our conversation.
And then they kept modifying the airplanes, and they'd add on, well, like they added on the ball turret, they added on the nose turret, they put more armor plating on, and pretty soon the later model ones, you couldn't fly as well on three as you could the early ones with two.
That's right. Everybody would, you'd get a picture and name the airplane. The name of mine, I think, was Pink Lady. When we went over, overseas, they would paint your airplanes a little different. And the planes that we flew to North Africa were painted a kind of a pink color. I don't know as it did really any good, but anyway, that's what they did. Many of the airplanes were just a regular OD when they ended up over there, but they were supposed to be a sort of a pink color.
Hmm. You were stationed in North Africa, and once you got there, what did you discover your assignment was to be?
We reported into Cairo, and then they assigned us from there, and we were assigned to what they called the 376th Bomb Group, which was the first four engine airplanes that had been in the European theater. And it had started out as a, I think they called it the Helpro Group. We were directly under English control. In other words, they decided where and when we'd bomb and so forth and so on. And from there, we were stationed, the 376th was stationed at a little town called Saluk. It was about 100 miles from Benghazi. And it was just a dirt field. And when you left Cairo, they told you where it was. For security reasons, the name of your tower that you would call, they didn't tell you. I mean, that's the way they kept it. They didn't have any, even at Cairo, they couldn't tell you what the call letters were and so forth for the bombers that were in combat. The name of our tower was Life Boy. You call Life Boy Tower. This is number so and so.
What number did you use, by the way? I'm sure you must have that memorized.
The number of the airplane I flew?
Yeah.
Oh, you flew... That was another thing. They assigned you this airplane, this beautiful new airplane, and the minute you landed at the base that you were assigned to in combat, they took it away from you. In other words, one of the fellows that had been over there got the new airplane.
I see.
And then you'd get some experience in the old clunkers, and then when you had a little bit of experience, why, a new crew that came in with a new airplane, then you'd get a new one.
I see.
I ended up with number 88 as my airplane.
Was that the full number, or was that...
No, that was the squadron number.
I see.
I was stationed, the 515 squadron was the number of the squadron, and our squadron insignia was three little devils riding on a bomb, the two end little devils were holding up their whole hand with five fingers, and the middle one held up one finger. 515.
I'd ask which one, but I won't. Okay. So, at this point, we are trying to determine at what point did you determine what your mission was or what your purpose was. You must have had some objective in being there. That you were to provide protection for something, or
well. We were right across the Mediterranean Ocean from Italy, and most of our bombing was in Italy, and we were stationed at Saluk on this little dirt field.
Was this aggressive action? I mean, would this be termed aggression today?
Yes. We were going way past the fighting and way up into Italy. Some of the first places we bombed was Naples. Now, at Saluk, you've probably all heard of the Lady Be Good, the B-24 that they found, some oil exploring crew found about 20 years later.
Out in the desert?
Yes. Hatton, the airplane commander of that crew, was a friend of mine. There were six of us that went overseas together, six crews. And
he was one of them, huh?
And he was one of them. When we got over there, the weather was real bad. It was raining.
And I think Hatton got there 2 or 3 days ahead of me, and he took his crew up on a bombing mission to Naples, and he got lost on the way back, and I'm sure that a lot of you have read the story about it, what happened to him. The thing that remains in my mind was his crew lived in a tent next to mine, and my navigator came over and he said, you know, we're in a tough racket here. He says, everybody over here is playing for keeps. He said, you know, these fellas in the tent next to us, he said, they're not home, and he says, they're not ever going to come home. And it kind of dawned on us that it was going to be a rough go there.
You realized it was for real.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what happened over there, we had a direction finding station on a island called Malta, which was a little ways off of Sicily, and the English had this, and if you got lost, you would radio them for a fix, and they'd tell you what course to fly to get home. Well, the Germans are pretty intelligent, so they put a station on Sicily just across the channel from Malta, and just almost the same frequency and about 2 or 3 times as strong. And they would tell our airplanes, give them a bad fix. And, for instance, instead of telling them which way land was, they'd turn them around, say, you've gone past, come back. And another tactic they'd use, Sicily wasn't far from Malta, and they actually had one of our B-24s land on their air base. Well, and the crew didn't realize where they were until they were all the way in the mess hall. And the story we got was that the Germans had them as POWs, and they had to keep the navigator and the pilot separate. The pilot was he was pretty perturbed at the navigator, and I guess he they'd fight all the time if they were together in the even in the POW camp.
This particular part of the conversation is what really caught my ear when we were talking last fall. You told me that flying up and down Italy, you flew north and south along the mountains there, along, I think it was on the western coast.
Yes, on the Adriatic side.
And that, in fact, you were told that there was a base that you could land at if you got in trouble.
Yes.
Tell us that story again.
Well, later on, and after we'd been over there a while, and after our ground troops had taken Sicily, and they were going up through Italy, which was in the fall of 1943, in your briefing before you'd take off every day, why they'd tell you the last field that was ours that you could land at. And we had some engine trouble and I don't know, a little bit of control trouble coming back from up the Adriatic. I can't remember just where we were bombing up there. It was somewhere up north of, I think it was Brindisi. And so the whole crew had quite a bit of time. In other words, we were over the halfway mark to have enough credits to get home. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, we had to fly have 300 combat hours.
I
then
see.
Then you were rotated home. And so we circled this field that they'd given us in the briefing that was our field. And I think we circled it 2 or 3 times trying to make up our mind what we'd do. Well, most of the fellas voted that they'd rather go down and land on Sicily, which was ours. And we decided that we could go along the coast. We were over land, and if worst came to worst, we could always bail out, and we'd be probably in friendlier territory. So we elected to go on to Sicily and land, which we did, and come to find out they had made an error in our briefing. The Germans still controlled this field that we had circled. So, but they were pretty much on the run. There wasn't any. They didn't shoot at us.
What was the airplane problem? Was it combat related or mechanical?
It was pretty much just mechanical. We just had some bad engines.
Did you ever really take any serious hits?
Oh yes. I don't know. We had number 88 and. I know one of the ground crew, he was always teasing me. He said, Lieutenant, he'd say, when this war is over and we get back to the States and I've got a nice new convertible, he said, I'll never let you drive it. Just kind of to tease. I don't know, it kind of run in cycles. First, one fella get hit pretty well, and I've had him just whistle when you'd come home. And sometimes they'd shoot, I've had the nose gear flatten several times, which was no problem. If they would happen to hit one of the main gear tires and flatten it, why, the trick was you'd lower your gear and then you'd have one of your waist gunners shoot the other side out so it'd be even. In other words, so you could go straight. You wouldn't go very far, but you just shoot the other tire out.
Fantastic. Well, now...
Well, that had happened fairly often. I've seen it happen several times.
I have no conception of what it's like to do a bombing run. First of all, tell me what happens. You take off. You open your orders again, and it tells you where you're headed. Or you got this in your briefing?
No, you'd go in for a briefing, and they would have everything detailed out. You'd have a leader that would lead the formation, and a deputy leader if something happened to him, and right on down the line. And they'd even have it figured out. They'd have a weather report. And, of course, you always wanted to make your bombing run downwind so you wouldn't be over the target any longer than was necessary. We'd go out over the Mediterranean, and we'd usually fly about 1,500 or 2,000 feet.
Above surface elevation?
Above the surface. And then we would...
That's not really very high.
No.
Was this to stay below radar?
No, it wasn't exactly to stay below radar. It was just to fly down where the airplane was easier on your equipment. But
you were more susceptible to ground fire.
Well, you see, there wasn't any ground fire out over the Mediterranean.
Uh-huh.
In other words, and then we would start our climb so that we'd be at our altitude before we got to the target. Well, they'd always... shoot a flare gun. In other words, the lead airplane, when he was going to start his climb, maybe a minute before, why, they'd shoot a red flare, and that was because of the radio silence. I mean, you didn't want to be talking on your radio going in, and that would signal that in so many seconds why he'd start the climb, and you'd get your prop setting set and ready to climb. And we were lucky over there. We didn't usually have to go very far at altitude. In other words, maybe we'd only be at altitude 5 minutes before we'd hit the target. And then after we bombed, why, we'd always make a right or a left turn with the formation and start descending, maybe 200 feet a minute. So if somebody had an engine out or something, why, that would enable them to stay up with the formation. And then we'd head out over the water.
I see.
Did you ever get in a situation where you had to break formation and get away from the rest of the people?
Well, no. The only time you'd break formation is if you had trouble with your airplane and just couldn't keep up. I remember one time we had two groups over there, the 98th group, and I knew this pilot that this happened to, but usually we'd have one group hit the target and going one way, and then maybe a minute or two later, where the other group had hit him going in a little different direction. Well, as I remember it, this pilot's name was Morgan, and he was up with the 98th group, and that day they were just a minute or two ahead of us, and he was having engine trouble and couldn't keep up with his formation, so he just thought, well, I'll just tag on to the 376th bomb group when they come over. The only trouble was that day at briefing, they told us that the Germans had some of our airplane and they were flying them around. They had some P-38s, they had some B-24s that they'd captured. And they said, don't let any B-24s into your formation that can't identify themselves. Well, poor Morgan here, he came along and he wanted to join our formation, but we wouldn't let him. Every time he'd get so close, why, we'd say, well, shoot a burst of 50 calibers out in front of him. The poor fellow didn't have a friend in the world. I mean, here he was up over Italy, and he couldn't even join his buddies. They wouldn't let him. They were suspicious of him.
We're truly enjoying our conversation this morning with Jack Gorey. We've been kind of reliving an era that we know very little about.
trying to grasp a little bit of an understanding of what it was like. Jack, in a four-engine aircraft like that, a B-24, did the pilot and the co-pilot sit side by side?
Yes. It was set up, the pilot and co-pilot were side by side. I mean, there was a pedestal in between with your controls on it, so that both of you could reach them. The navigator was on the flight deck behind you. He had a little table that he could fold down, and he had a little window he could take his sextant to get his shots on and so forth.
Did you have a flight engineer?
The flight engineer, he was on the flight deck. The only specific place for him was when you went into combat, and he, flight engineer, ran the top turret.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand one thing. You said you flew in formations of 24, I believe.
Yes.
Why
24, 27 in the group.
On a bombing mission, why would it take 27 airplanes to destroy one bridge? Maybe I don't understand the scope.
Well, we really didn't bomb too many bridges. Railroad yards and airfields, supply dumps. We'd usually go back behind the lines quite a ways. When we got over to North Africa, Rommel was still in North Africa, and they had a supply line that would come down Italy, and they would barge railroad cars across the Straits of Messina over to Sicily. And it was a short hop up to Messina. It was about a six-hour flight out and back. And when I first got over there, the first the main job was to bomb the facilities at Messina to prevent Rommel from getting his supplies. And at that time, it was the most heavily defended target of the war, I believe. In other words, they called it Ack Alley to go up there. Your ground guns would really give you a bad problem. In other words, they had so many guns there, they just had a barrage, and you'd have to fly through the barrage.
Rommel was really kind of an underestimated leader, was he not? Wasn't he a lot more powerful than he was first estimated to be?
Well, he was a good leader. And if he had gotten the supplies that he was supposed to do, we'd have had a very rough time.
What was the range of these aircraft? You said 6 hours was a short hop.
Oh, a little over 2,000 miles would be your...
How many hours would that take?
Well, I've had missions up to almost around 12 hours.
Isn't that a long time to sit in a seat?
That's a real long time, especially when a lot of it's formation.
Compared with today's fighter airplanes that have a range of maybe an hour, in some cases, that's a long time in the air.
It's a long time. Of course, you're not exposed to any of the action only for usually a fairly short time, maybe a half hour.
Formation. How close together are you, wing to wing? How close?
Oh, you'd be you could see the people in the other airplane real easy. You'd be. Oh, you just tuck your wing right up in between the wing of the airplane you were flying on and their tail. In other words, the end of your wing would be past the end of their wing.
Wow. Now, was that necessary? It seems like
for mutual protection. And then we worked on a bombing pattern at that time. In other words, you had to be in close to get it to saturate your target.
I see.
In other words, our whole group could, if they were on, they could keep all the bombs within a 500-foot circle, say, out of your 24 airplanes. If
well,
they were right
that
on.
Is pinpoint bombing. That's respectable.
Okay. You know, my wife was in Italy this summer and tells me that there are still downed aircraft in Naples that the Italians have yet not removed from the streets.
That could be. Now, my wife was also over in Italy this, early this winter.
Uh-huh.
And she went on a tour, she went over to Germany, and then she went on a tour down to Italy. And she was in Naples, and she said that they still talk about that.
That's apparently. Did you ever have any thoughts about what you were destroying?
We were so high, you really couldn't see all of it.
By the way, how high were you when you let your payload out? Your bomb drops.
Around 25,000. In other words, that'd be about our average.
That's pretty high from 2,000 feet. You said you flew at 2,000 feet above this.
Yeah, we'd fly until we'd start our climb.
And then you climbed to 25,000 feet.
Climbed to 25,000.
You can't see. You can hardly tell what you're...
Well, we didn't have to see. The bombardier had his bomb sight down there, and you had a little needle you followed, and you're supposed to hold your altitude.
That's amazing. 500 feet radius, huh?
What sort of fighters did you encounter? You know,
well, mostly they were German fighters, and most of them were ME-109s or your FW-190.
Tell us about their capability.
We were lucky most of the time we were over there. They didn't they didn't get their attacks out until usually after we had dropped our bombs. We learned several things over there. They'd start shooting, like for instance, if they were shooting AK-AK at us from the ground batteries, well, then they would shoot the colored AK-AK. In other words, the smoke off of them would be red or green or blue or something. And we learned that when we got the colored AK-AK, hang on, because that was a signal that they would quit firing so that their fighter airplanes could come in and work you over. Their range wasn't too much. However, I can remember one time, I think we had a flight at 24, and for some reason we hit a little clouds coming off the target, and I was in a box of six airplanes, and we were out over the ocean a little ways, and lo and behold, here came a whole bunch of ME-109s. Well, of course, they picked on the box of six instead of the box of 18. And come to find out, they were the professionals that had been sent down there to teach the other fighter pilots how to do things. And I tell you, we had some fun for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
As it happened, the general was riding in our lead plane of this box of six. And they were real good. There was only one thing that saved us. They knew how close they could get to us before we could get them. Consequently, they were just taking deflection shots. They wouldn't get in close enough to where we could do any damage to them. And they would go out ahead of us and then come right toward us. And they were really good. I mean, they could roll their airplane and keep right on firing their guns, and while they were upside down coming right at you, still firing and getting them right in there, too.
In that particular airplane, the people on the flight deck were fairly vulnerable to that sort of attack.
That's right.
Because you were just sitting in basically a glass bubble.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the thing was that they went so fast that the gun turrets couldn't keep up with them. In other words, they couldn't turn them fast enough. And when they'd come in upside down, they'd go just barely underneath us, and they had a lot of armor plate there. I know we'd hit them, but they'd just bounce off.
What's it look like? It almost looked like a movie screen to see the airplanes just right out there in front of
you. Well, of course, when you were flying it, you couldn't see all of it all the time. Your crew would call out which way they were coming. But of course, when they're coming in right straight at you, you could see them all right. And they shot some little explosive shells, and all of a sudden there'd be poof, poof, poof right out in front of you maybe, and then pretty soon it'd start rattling on the airplane where it'd hit you.
Did you ever get in a situation where you lost hydraulics or something by, you know, taking that kind of abuse?
Oh, yeah. Of course, a B-24 was a hydraulic airplane. In other words, everything was pretty well operated hydraulically.
Yeah.
Your landing gear and your flaps, the pitch on your propellers, which was a separate hydraulic system, however, your brakes, and... It wasn't too uncommon to come in with no hydraulics whatsoever.
What did you do? Put it down manually?
You'd have to put it down manually.
Do you have a pump there where you get out and pump it down? Is that what you do?
They had both. They had an emergency hydraulic pump that you pump without,
However, if they'd hit your line, you lost all your fluid, well, then you had to crank them out by hand.
Wow.
Did they have, this is curious, one thing intrigued me when I started working with fighter airplanes. One in particular had an auxiliary hydraulic pump that was wind-driven. It would look nothing, looked exactly like a little cooling fan that you'd see sitting in a room, you know, cooling, except for it fell out of the fuselage of the airplane, and it drove a little hydraulic pump just by your forward airspeed. And that was one of the backup hydraulic systems. And I always, it looked like a little toy hanging on this, you know, million-dollar aircraft. Was it that kind of deal? Did you have
it was just a little
hand operated.
Yeah, just like a hydraulic jack handle, and the co-pilot had it over there, and he had to, as I remembered, he had to close one valve and open another one to use this little pump.
Okay, 23 minutes past 9. Dale, do we have to take a commercial break? One more? Okay, we'll do that. Then we're going to come back, and we're going to ask Jack to go into one other area with us. We kept him here way longer than we said we would. And I'll preface this so that our listeners won't run away, because I think they'll find this an interesting thing to talk about. But during this period of time, we had the infamous flight of Amelia Earhart. And I want to talk to you about that in just a moment.
That was before.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well,
a plane that was shot down next to me and what happened.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll do that. We'll come back in a minute. Thank you very much. 25 minutes past 9, and our guest is Jack Gray. We've been talking about a bundle of things. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry I didn't. I should have told you that I was going to ask it. Let me tell you the reason I wanted to ask about Amelia Earhart was that several years ago I read a fascinating book called The Flight of Amelia Earhart. It was written by Eric Gorner, G-O-E-H-R-N-E-R. He was a newsman for CBS, kind of a Washington Post type of reporter of 10 years ago, a very, very investigative type man who in his book makes some very strong contentions about Amelia Earhart and the nature of her flight, that she wasn't proving that a woman could fly around the world. She was actually a paid spy. Do you have any knowledge of anything such as that?
I don't have any direct knowledge. However, I think that the United States government knew that the Japanese were fortifying some of the Pacific Islands. There was no way to find out, maybe, unless they could fly an airplane over there and take some pictures. And I don't have anything for sure, but I would be suspicious that maybe she did have some cameras and trying to take some pictures. Could be. I don't.
Was it a conventional thing to have a woman pilot?
Oh, no.
Okay. That was kind of an unusual thing in itself. Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about what you said you'd like to talk about. I had no idea. In fact, I all the time we've been talking, I had no idea that you talked as though your 24 planes in formation never had a problem.
You did have some problems.
Oh, yes, you always had problems. When I first went over there, for instance, an engine that you were supposed to get 1,000 hours of time on, we got about 50. On account of the dust, they made some modifications, and we learned how to operate them a little better. And when I left over there, we were getting up to an average of about 200 hours per engine.
No, then they go down for complete overhaul, huh?
No, they would send us overhauled engines there, and I can remember one time when I had flew an airplane in the afternoon. And the crew had 4 new engines on it the next morning to take out.
Wow.
I can remember it because the crew chief came out and he said, now look, he said, we've got these engines changed, our throttle linkage and the turbo linkage and so forth. In other words, your throttles, one might be 3 or 4 inches ahead of the other and when you take off. And he just said, we'd sure like to make this mission now. If something doesn't look right, why, come back. And sometimes you would have trouble. For instance, one time I took off, they told me I had the speed limit for the runway. I took off for a bombing mission, heavy loaded, and I had 2 props that overspeeded. And I couldn't control them. I couldn't keep them down without pulling the throttles a long ways back. So we finally made it around the traffic pattern where we could line up and land.
The crew chief came out, and we checked the engines again, and we changed the oil in the prop hubs, and he said, well, I'd sure like for you to try it again, see if we can get going. And so we trundled back down and started down the runway, and we thought we just about had it made. We had all the weight off of the oleo struts on the landing gear and going over 100 miles an hour and just ready to start kind of easing the plane off the ground, and doggone if those two engines didn't take off again and run away. Well, I'd had enough of this just barely getting back to the base, and we had a lot of room over there. When you ran past the end of the runway, it was just kind of a hard pan out there, so I just pulled the throttles off. Well, we went past the end of the runway going just a little over 100 miles an hour. But we forgot one thing. In our landing, we had used quite a bit of brakes, and our brakes were hot. When we went to stop, there was no way to stop. And we were getting down in the tent area. And the only way we could steer was to blast an outside engine. And we went down through the tent area and made a big sachet out there. Everybody was running out of our way. And when we finally stopped, while the brakes were on fire, we had to get the fire extinguishers out. It was kind of hilarious. So after that, they'd always say, well, Gorey's got the speed record for the runway.
Tell me, it sounds like your crew chiefs were pretty anxious to make an airplane fly. Was it their reputation at stake, whether you aborted or not? They wanted that airplane to go?
That's correct. In other words, like I told you before, I had number 88, and we set a record on consecutive missions.
Without having to ground aboard.
Without having
turning
to
around
ground
or something. Yeah.
Right.
I see.
And
You didn't, about this braking problem, you didn't have reverse thrust like jets do.
Oh, no. We just had a hydraulic brake is what it was, and they used expander tubes, they called it.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, if you used your brakes too much, you'd blow an expander tube, and then that cuts your braking power on that wheel just 50%. In other words, you just had half as much.
Flying at 20,000 feet, you completed a bombing mission. You encounter fire from fighter planes. What happens? You said you were in situations where you saw the plane next to you take a hit.
Well, yes. You'd get it from both from the ground and from the air. Now they had several tactics they used. And of course, the longer we were over there, it just seems like they kept moving. The ground guns went up the coast, and the longer we were there, the better they got. You could almost tell when they were going to hit you.
Of course, that was true for you too.
That's right.
Yeah, it was kind of a proficiency thing.
Towards the end of my tenure over there, a friend of mine. In fact, we'd gone to flying school together. We ended up in the same squadron. His name was Don Hurd. When we bombed Rome, I never will forget this, they said the 12th Air Force led by General Doolittle and the 9th Air Force led by First Lieutenant Donald B. Hurd, which was my classmate. It just kind of shows, in other words, in our outfit, it was capability as much as anything else on who led. And after the Rome raid, we were going up over Foggia in the middle of Italy, and I think I was flying on Don's left wing, and he got two direct hits from, J-88 anti-aircraft guns. And the only thing for him to do, in other words, it just went right through the middle of the airplane, was for him to jump out. And this is quite a story in itself. We could see all of them jumping out, the first thing you're supposed to do is the crew members to try and count how many people come out of an airplane if they bail down where you can see them. And I could remember the navigator came out, and he had to hold of his knee in kind of a ball. He was right down out in front of you, maybe 50 feet or 100 feet. You could see him real well. And
were you over the water?
No, we were over land.
Oh, okay. That's all right.
And, first of all, we counted 10 men, and there only should have been 9. and several of the crew member did. Now, that's another story. I'll have to get back to that. But anyway, Jack Ryder, I could see him, the navigator, tumbling out. And he was quite a fellow. He was from New York. He was highly intelligent. He was our squadron intelligence officer. He could speak several languages very fluently. And we thought everybody in the airplane got out all right. And when we got back to the base, we were kind of chuckling about Jack Ryder. We said, well, the Germans have got him now in POW camp, and we wonder what big story he's telling them. I mean, he was just that type of a fella. He was very outgoing. And I didn't see Jack until I was back in the States and an instructor in Pueblo, Colorado. And let's see, that was in, I'd say August. And about next April or May, I walked in the mess hall, and who should be sitting there but Jack Ryder and his wife. And I couldn't believe it, and I was almost shook up to see him. And I went over and talked to him, and ate lunch with him. He introduced me to his wife, and I said, Jack, the last time I saw you, and I told him, I said, you had a hold of your legs when you jumped out. And he looked at me. He said, did you see me that close? And I said, I sure did. Yeah, he said, that's right. So I said, well, what happened to you? And he said, well, he broke his pelvic bone when his chute opened. He didn't have his straps on his parachute harness quite tight enough. And when he jolted of it, it broke some bones. And he said he was really pretty sick. And but anyway, a German sergeant came out, and he had what would be a German Army a Jeep, and picked him up, and he said he was, you know, treated him real good and everything, and they took him and put him in the hospital. And so our Army was going up the coast of Italy, and they had to move him. So they put him on a stretcher and on a train. The train stopped for water up in Italy somewhere, and there were some Italians there that were taking care of him, and he bribed them to leave him on his stretcher at this water station. And somehow I think he had some connections with the guerrillas, and so they took him, and
Because he was a counterintelligence man?
Right.
Okay.
But anyway, they put him in a hospital, in a civilian hospital in Italy. Well, before he got well, the German Army captured the hospital, so here was Jack again, he said. They had him again. Well, he said, I can't tell you how I got loose this time, you know, for security reasons, but he said, I had no problem escaping the next time. He said, I was ready to get out of the hospital anyway, and he'd already made his connection with the guerrillas. And so he got out, and he was with this guerrilla band, and they were supplied by airdrops. The English had some four-engine airplanes, and they would drop. And they'd bomb railroad and so forth, and set off dynamite blasts. And he said the main thing they needed was shoes. But anyway, they'd missed several of their drops, and they were running out of supplies, and they were also running out of money. The guerrillas that Jack belonged to, and they'd trying to decide what to do. Well, they said, we're in the right. Our cause is just. We'll just rob a bank and get some money. Well, who are we going to have rob the bank? Well, here's an American from New York City. They all know all about robbing banks. So he was it. And so he said he went into this little town and had a revolver and went in and held up the bank. And he said, I don't know how much money I got, maybe $150, something like that. But anyway, he had to rob the bank. And he was with the guerrillas for a while, and he collected some information, and then our people got him out when they were ready. And I think he helped them bomb a fighter strip that they couldn't locate before. And he said he went back to Washington, D.C., and then he was sent out as an instructor navigator to instruct combat crews at Pueblo, where I was.
Amazing. What happened? Just let me ask you one other question. Explain the 10 people.
The 10 people. Well, before we took off,
There were a lot of troops coming back from North Africa. In other words, they had kicked Rommel out by this time, and they were kind of regrouping and going by the our base. And there'd be a lot of times a lot of trucks of all types and descriptions. There'd be English and French Foreign Legion and just a regular deal going back, and they'd set up camps. Well, this English artillery captain came over and wanted to know if he could ride with us on a mission. Well, we wouldn't let him. I mean, it was kind of against regulations, but he was a gung-ho fella, I guess is one way to put it, and he wanted to see what we were doing, our side of the war. Well, he went over and he got on Don Hurd's crew. Somebody let him on their plane. They got him a parachute. So he was going along to see what the bombers were doing on the war, but he got shot down.
Tell me, in an ejection?
The reason that we found out was that the English were missing this captain, and they traced him to where he was trying to get on one of our airplanes, and they put it together. That must be the fella.
Okay, excuse me, Steve, but one last question, and then it's all yours. But what happened to the other men? You did run into this one fellow. Do you know what happened to the others?
Jack never would tell me what he didn't tell me that Don Hurd, but Don was killed in some way, and actually I didn't know that until I read in the book after the war. I guess Jack, just for my feelings, he just kind of
in a situation where he had to bail out of an airplane. You were never in that situation yourself.
No, I've had my feet hanging out a couple of times.
Yeah. You went out through the bottom?
Yes, we'd go out through the bomb bay.
You'd have to actually get up and move back?
We'd have to get out of our seat and go back probably 7 or 8 feet, and there was a little door that went into the bomb bay, and then the bomb bay door more open.
That's a bad situation if you were in, say, took a real strong hit where you went into a spin or something. You'd have trouble fighting centrifugal forces and the forces to get back there to get out.
I guess there was quite a few people lost their lives because they just couldn't get out of the airplane. The centrifugal forces, you say, would hold them in, and they couldn't pry out. Now
you couldn't pop the canopy either. You did that.
No,
you didn't have
no.
A canopy as
no.
such. Yeah.
No, the only thing that they said was that the aircraft commander was supposed to be the last one out of the airplane in case of an emergency, and I told my crew that was fine, but they better be damn quick getting out because they'd be trampled because I was on my way out. The biggest fear in getting out in a hurry was fire. If your airplane was on fire, why?
Yeah.
But
the thing I just still think, you know, but you get up and walk away from the controls of an aircraft, it's going to fly basically in the same position for some time, but there's going to be a point at which it's going to start to take off and go one way or the other, right?
Right.
You don't have a whole lot of time to mess around. In other words, did you have to when you decided to abandon ship like that? If you did, was it to practice to drop out of the formation so that you didn't?
That's right. You'd pull out, and
I see.
Of course, if you had time and you could, you'd try and snap it on automatic pilot.
I see.
Yeah.
You flew over the Mediterranean quite a bit. Did you have life belts and flotation devices?
Oh, yes. We had. We always wore a Mae West. I mean, all the time you were in the airplane. And then we had two life rafts.
I see.
They were up on top of the fuselage, and you pull a handle, and they were supposed to go out and inflate.
Did you have people ditching in the ocean?
Yes. Yes. In fact, one time.
Would you go down and watch them? You'd be at 2,000 feet anyway.
No. In other words, when you were on a mission, nobody was supposed to stop. You were supposed to go on. However, one time there was a fella, I don't know what happened to him, just after we left the base, and he went in the water, and one of our planes circled around, and you weren't supposed to do this, because if you were flying and you released this raft, it might hang up on the tail of the airplane, and you'd be in real trouble. But this friend of mine, another classmate of mine, he kind of broke the regulations. Well, I can't say he broke regulations. He kind of warped them a little bit and pulled out and went in and dropped his life rafts and saved most of the crew. Huh.
In other words, their plane exploded and their rafts were gone when they hit and helped them. And the pilot, he went back to the outfit and flew.
Looking back on this whole experience, is it something that's like a dream, or is it real? Does it really strike home to you?
No, it's kind of like a dream. In other words, there was so much happening, and some of it that you actually did see, you couldn't hardly believe. People, you know, the way they'd be shot down and so forth. And I can remember one time we were on a bombing run, and there were some German fighter planes up quite a ways above us. And the engineer in the top turret, he called to me. He says, "Can you lower your right wing? Lower your right wing." Well, you have to be able to do this and still keep a semblance of a formation. And I lowered the right wing, and he fired at a plane that was thought he was out of range, but he had some kind of little bombs hanging on the bottom of it, and the plane blew up. And actually, you could see the pilot come out of this plane and open his parachute and go on down.
Jack, do you fly now?
No, I don't.
I always wondered about that. Why so many people who have so much aviation background, oftentimes after they get out, never pursue it?
Oh, I pursued it some. I had me a little Cessna 140 after the war.
That's hardly a B-24.
No, it's altogether different, I'll tell you. You almost had to learn to fly over again.
Maybe that was maybe it was such a anticlimactic type of experience after flying such a big plane.
That's right. I know the first time I flew a light airplane was right after I came back from overseas, and to get our flight pay, you have to fly 4 hours every month. And so another pilot and I, they gave us a little L5, and we didn't tell them that we didn't have any experience in a light airplane like that. And we went in and checked our parachutes out, and we went out the door, and this other fellow said, "Say, Gray," he said, "you've got some experience in one of these light airplanes, I hope." And I said, "No, I haven't flown anything but a B-24 since I've been out of flight school." He says, "I haven't flown anything but a B-17. What'll we do?" And I said, "Well, let's go out and see what we can do." So we went out, and the crew chief showed us how everything worked on the plane. And as I remember it, why he got in and flew it first, and we got it in the air, and I can remember that he said, "Say, I wonder what happens. How do you turn the engine off on one of these things?" And I said, "No, I don't think I'd do that if I were you. I think that I don't think it'll windmill and start." "Well, maybe we better not." Well, then he came in and landed, and we traded seats, and I got in the front, and it was my turn to fly. And we flew around a while, and then when I went in to land, I pulled the throttle back, and lo and behold, the engine just quit. And it didn't windmill, but it was a big long runway, so we just we made it in all right, no problem. It was kind of comical the way we came in, but then...
Any landing's a good one, providing
you... That's right. Well, naturally, when you're flying a big airplane, your airspeed is so critical that we came in. We probably had half again as much airspeed as we should have to land this small airplane.
You watch Walter Cronkite did a series called The You Are There, I think that was what it was called, and it was quite an extensive series on the World War II. Dealt quite a bit with aviation and the Air Corps. Did you ever see any of those series? What I'm going to ask you is that, do you find that the things that we see on television and in film today depicts the reality of what it was all about?
A lot of them are pretty real, like.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we've certainly had a wonderful conversation this morning. It's kept you a lot longer than we told you we would, but it's been very, very worthwhile. Steve, you have anything you'd like to add?
No, I think it's been great. Enjoyed it very much.
Well, I've enjoyed it myself, and like I say, my family tells me every time I tell these stories, they get just a little bit better. They say I add on just a little. You can't say it's really lying. You just make things sound better. But basically, they're all true, what I've told you.
Well, I really want to thank you. It's been delightful, and I hope our listeners have found it as valuable as we have. We have about 9 minutes, or 10 minutes before the hour, 5 minutes away from ABC News. To you in the control room, it's all yours. And to you in the audience, we thank you for listening and hope you found this beneficial this morning. Jerry Eisenhardt along with Steve Bykwist, and our guest this morning has been Jack Gorey.